This is the true story of Ratman being told tonight, August the 4th, 1977, at Trailblazer Inn at Camp Ridgecrest in Ridgecrest, North Carolina. Those persons witnessing the true story of Ratman are the Trailblazers of the second session of 1977 and one cabin of the Shawnee tribe. Those persons in the Trailblazers for this session who are witnessing this fantastic true story are
John Story,
Glenn Winter,
Tim Sherrill,
Andy Miller,
Bernard, David Pope,
Ron Roman,
Rick Pond,
Gary Palmer,
Jim Hardy,
Wally Shaw,
Bob Talbert,
Hal King,
Tom Deal,
and
Cabin 7.
Plus the narrator, the Woody Woodsman, Tiny Turkey, Steve Little, giving you this true story of Rat Man. Our story begins in the year 1899. In 1899, in New York City, there were slums. There were tall buildings, and there was garbage in the streets. There were creatures running throughout because it was poor sanitation. In 1899, in one particular tenement house, a very high-rise building, a lady was about to give birth to a child. Now, this was a very poor family. They had no money for doctors, no money for hospitals, no money for medicines or for drugs. They had not even enough money for food. One dark, hot, sultry, nasty summer night, this woman gave birth to a little boy. Now, in New York City, in this particular tenement, high-rise apartment slum where this woman gave birth, it was nasty, it was filthy, it was grimy, it was despicably dirty and vile and bad. That night, shortly after giving birth, these nasty, vile, despicable creatures, otherwise known as rats, made their way into the bedroom, as they often did, and bit the mother, and bit the little baby boy. A newborn babe, innocent as a driven snow, being bitten by a rat, the nasty, vile, despicable creatures that they are. Bit that poor little innocent baby and the mother. Now, this was not a unique situation to New York City. True, they did not have good sanitation, but this could have happened in any city in the United States because at that time, sanitation systems were very inadequate. Garbage and scum developed everywhere. This could have taken place in Chicago, in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Denver, Salt Lake City, Miami, Fort Worth, Cleveland, Boston, Philadelphia, Portland, Honolulu, Anchorage, Raleigh, New Orleans, Birmingham, Atlanta, Delray Beach, or even Old Fort. But it did not. It took place in New York City, of all places, where there were nasty, vile, despicable creatures, these rats, biting on people. The mother got very, very sick, as was very common. The poor baby turned red with fever, horrible fever. The mother went into convulsions, began to dribble upon crazily, making no sense for days, till finally the fever overcame her and she expired. The little baby was more fortunate. He was very ill, but somehow managed to survive. Now, as this child grew up in New York City, in the slums, among all the garbage and all the filth without any sanitation system, he was confronted almost daily with the problems of rats, these vile, despicable, nasty creatures. He hated them. He didn't know why he hated them. Maybe because they took his food away. Maybe because they bit him. Maybe because they were just vile and nasty and despicable as they were. But he hated them. And so did other people. The city people in charge of New York City would put out rat poison, try and kill these foul, nasty, vile, despicable creatures. Didn't always work. In fact, very seldom worked. But it did harm people. For you see, these people were so poor, had so little food, so little money, they would go out and rummage in the trash cans and the garbage cans among all the scum and the filth of the streets just to feed themselves. Well, the rats ate there too. So the city people would put rat poison out there among these garbage cans, all this filth and grime and scum and nastiness. And one day, one of this boy's favorite playmates, while rummaging for food, eating a banana peel, happened to eat some rat poison at the same time, by accident. His very good playmate friend died from eating this rat poison. This made him very, very sad. Other people died from the same kind of rat poison. There were attempts by the city fathers to kill the rats, but all it did was kill the people instead. As a young boy got into school, he learned that he had a very good talent in the area of science, particularly in chemistry. He found out upon reaching junior high school age that his mother had been bitten by a rat and had died because of a rat bite, and that he had been bitten by a rat at the same time, and that he had gotten very, very ill from this rat bite. So, in school, he began to work very, very hard in science and in chemistry, and did very, very well in those areas because he began to form a desire to develop a rat poison that would kill rats yet not harm people. That was his goal, because cities all over the country, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Denver, Los Angeles, Miami, Boston, Fort Worth, Delray Beach, all these places, filth, grime, rats, everywhere. So he wanted to get this rat poison that would kill rats yet not harm people. In high school, he did very well in sciences. He did very well in all of high school, so well that he won a scholarship to Columbia University. Now, you may ask, what was this boy's name? And my response will be, I ain't going to tell you. Because, you see, this is a very personal story, a story of great achievement, yet great anguish and dishonor. I do know the person's name, but I'm not going to say it. There are rumors that his name is David Swangard. I shall neither confirm nor deny that. But that is what one story says. But his name in my story will remain anonymous. So, Anonymous got this scholarship to Columbia University. While there, he began to study in depth biology, chemistry, physics, all kinds of sciences, but particularly chemistry. That was his major area of study. He would spend hours and hours every day in a laboratory learning chemical compounds, What chemicals reacted with what other chemicals to produce what results? Particularly, he was interested in toxics. Toxics being poisons. And particularly, what chemicals were poisonous to rats, those vile, nasty, despicable creatures. But he also wanted to get something that would not harm people. Not very easy to do. Because, you see, both rats, those nasty, vile, despicable creatures, and humans are mammals. And a lot of the same chemicals have the same reactions in all mammals. So it was a very difficult task to find a chemical or a chemical compound that would kill rats yet not harm people. But for years, 4 years of undergraduate study at Columbia University, he worked toward that goal. He worked so hard, he became pretty well known among the professors of Columbia University. And his senior year, they advised him that if he made application, they felt like he could get a scholarship or a fellowship to Yale University to go into graduate school and eventually get his PhD or his doctorate in chemistry. Because they knew what his intentions were. They knew what his goal was, to find a poison that would kill rats yet not harm people. And that was a very laudable, very noteworthy, very delightful, exciting, wonderful, good, fantastic, super nice goal to have. And people were very excited about it. So they said, why don't you go ahead on and apply and get that fellowship and go to Yale University. And then you can get your doctorate and become well-trained and know what you're doing. So he did. He applied to Yale University and was accepted. Went to Yale. He put in so much work, it was just hard to believe. Unimaginable how it could be so difficult to work hours and hours in a chemical laboratory, studying, working with chemicals and with compounds and with mixtures of things to see what would kill rats and yet not harm other kinds of creatures, but particularly people. But after 3 long years of study, he became a doctor, a full-fledged PhD in chemistry. Not a medical doctor, but nonetheless a doctor. I mean, he knew about everything there was to know about chemistry. He could have been a druggist easily, a pharmacist, because that was the kind of things he studied. Pharmacology, mixing different drugs and compounds together. When he finished with Yale University, having done his major papers on the study of toxics and poisons, he was pretty well known among the better known schools and the better known chemistry professors of all schools in the whole eastern part of the United States. Because, you see, rats were a problem everywhere. Not just New York, but Chicago, San Francisco, Denver, Salt Lake City, Houston, Miami, Atlanta, Savannah, Delray Beach, all these places. So people were excited. They said, we're going to get rid of these rats. Hooray, hooray. But it didn't quite happen that easily. Because, you see, after 4 years of study at Columbia University, after 4 more years at Yale University, still there was not one substance that could kill rats yet not harm people. What to do, he thought. What can I do? I cannot afford to pay for this myself. I've got to have some assistance to continue. Aha, he thought. A brainstorm one night. The federal government had just at that time, and this was in the late 20s, to be exact, this was in 1927, the late part of 1927, the summer, late summer. The federal government had just begun a program of giving federal grants. Now, federal grants are found in all areas these days. brand new concept back in 1927. The only previous federal aid ever given had been to World War I veterans, hospital benefits and things like that. So this was, in effect, a grant from the federal government in the area of education, because, you see, this was an urban blight problem. Now, we hear much about urban blight today, and we've got it today, but they had it bad back in 1927. This was a problem throughout the whole United States. So the U.S. government decided it was worth it to invest money to let this man who had begun and done so much work in the area to continue to find a rat poison that would kill these vile, nasty, despicable creatures and not harm people. So, he applied for the grant, and some of a gun he got it. Money coming out of his ears. Thousands of dollars to build a laboratory, to do research on killing rats, those nasty, vile, despicable creatures. But a problem presented itself, namely, where to build the laboratory. A big city would not do. Why, you may ask? I'll tell you why. Because there were rats all over the place in the big city. And the biggest fear in our good doctor's mind was the possibility of some rats escaping from his laboratory and further increasing the population of rats of a city. He did not want that to happen. So he dared not be in an urban area, a city area. He had to choose an area away from cities, away from people. But it couldn't be too far away, because, you see, there may be times when he needed to have supplies, chemicals, and near communication areas. A friend of his at Columbia University had been from Western North Carolina and had often spoken to the good doctor about what a delightful place it was. That was so beautiful up in this area. So, consequently, when he became in the area of looking around to find a place for a laboratory, he looked very carefully at Western North Carolina because of the things that his friend had said. This was only one of many areas he was investigating. But you see, there was another problem. In 1927, many areas, most likely, it should be said that most areas of this country did not have electricity. He had to have electricity for his laboratory. So a dilemma was there. He did not know where he could go. Because, you see, he knew that he had to produce his own electricity. So the areas he was considering began to grow smaller and smaller, the number, that is, until finally, one area seemed best suited for his needs. That area was the area near Old Fort, North Carolina. More precisely, the area between Old Fort and Ridgecrest, North Carolina. Very near a place known to us all as Catawba Falls. Now, the reason Catawba Falls area was chosen was because of the natural supply of free-falling water. Because with the water falling from the waterfall, the water pressure, he'd be able to generate his own electricity. Now, another feature of this area that made it very desirable was the location of a brand new hospital at Oteen, which is just outside of Asheville. This was a brand new hospital built for veterans, the VA hospital at Oteen. When this hospital was finished in 1927, it was the newest hospital in the United States. It was most modern, the best equipped hospital this country had seen. And when it was finished, it was the newest. So this was a delightful area. A lot of appeal. Brand new hospital. Intelligent doctors down there. Lots of chemicals and things there. A good area because there was good communications. Asheville was a pretty good sized city. A pretty decent highway ran from it. A good railroad, which of course went by Andrews Geyser on his way to Asheville. So, he decided he would choose the area near Catawba Falls. With federal money, he built a laboratory. Now, he didn't just go out and throw something together. Very carefully, he studied the area to pick the precise location for his laboratory. It had to be near the source of electricity because in the old days, and still today to some degree, the further electricity travels through the wires, the more efficiency is lost. Power loses its power. So he had to be very close to the generating facility. Consequently, the house was built right across from the stream, right beside the headwaters of the Catawba River. Now, this house cannot be seen today where this original laboratory was built, but you can see where the house was. Because, you see, even as we sit here with our eyes big, cringing in fear already, there stands a cinder block structure. This cinder block structure is down beside the water of the Catawba River, just after it has flowed down from the falls. This cinder block house down there at the falls area is the very exact same size as the laboratory. It was built on the very same spot as the original laboratory, using part of the very same foundation as this laboratory. You may have seen that cinder block house if you have gone down to Catawba Falls and gone on past it a little bit and camped. Many times people camp down there, particularly the Shawnee camp down there and the Choctaw. But do they know when they camp down there that that cinder block house stands on the very same foundation, the very same size as the original laboratory for our good doctor who hated the nasty, vile, despicable creatures, the rats? Well, you know it now. Think on it when you go down there next time. Well, he built his laboratory. In the same time, he built a generator to make electricity for his laboratory. The generating plant was built very sturdily, very strong, because it housed some very heavy equipment. It was not terribly large, but it was very sturdy. A small dam was built to back up the water, to increase the water pressure as it flowed down toward this little square generating plant sitting right beside the water on the opposite side of the stream from where the laboratory was. Even though the laboratory itself is not there, as you stand today, or if you go down there today and stand where the laboratory was, where the cinder block house is now, you can see the generating building. That plant is still down there. It's a square building. The roof is caving in, because the roof was not all that substantial. But the walls, notice the walls when you're down there. They're about 2 feet thick. Very substantial. You can see inside where the pipes ran down to the water, where the pipes came into the building from the dam to create the powerful surge of water necessary to create electricity. If you are brave, if you have intestinal fortitude, if you've got enough guts, when you're down there sometime, cross that stream and just touch the building. And if you are foolhardy with your guts, you may even walk into the building where the baryelectricity was generated for the doctor's laboratory. Now then, you can still see the building, you can still see the dam, and you can still see where the laboratory was. But when this laboratory was finished, it was even newer than the hospital at Otene. When it was finished, it was the most modern, newest building in the United States. And our good doctor inhabited it. Once a week, on Wednesday mornings, a friend would drive out to his place from Old Fort. For, you see, at that time, there was only one person in Old Fort who had an automobile. This being late 1927. As a matter of fact, it was in late December of 1927. It was very cold. There was no snow on the ground at that time when he moved in, but it was very cold. The policy was for his friend to drive out every Wednesday morning, bringing out some supplies of food, any messages that he may have, and any special orders that the good doctor had placed the week before. The good doctor lived by himself out there in his laboratory. There was a living quarters there, and at one room. He was there by himself because he was so diligent, such a fine, hard worker, that he worked sometimes as much as 16 hours a day. He was an ascetic, almost a hermit. He worked so hard, he had no time for pleasure because he was so dedicated to finding a poison that would kill rats yet not harm people. Nothing could keep him from working upon this project. So once a week, on Wednesday morning, he'd take out an hour to visit with his friend. Beginning in January of 1928, the good doctor was working very hard. I mean, he was working real hard. He thought he had the formula. After days and days and weeks of constant effort, testing and retesting, he thought he had a formula. Now, in his laboratory where he stayed all the time, there was a distinct separation between his small living quarters and the very large laboratory. One entire area of the laboratory was full of cages. Now, these cages were about 1 square foot in size. The very, very substantial steel bars on these cages, about as big as a pencil, but they were not this flimsy kind of stuff you see on cages these days. I mean, this, back when the good doctor's laboratory was built, they were substantial. It was pure steel. Very heavy. He had to have those because he wanted to take no chances that the rats could possibly escape into an area where there were no rats. Because, you see, there were no rats at all in this area. And what a horrible thing would be if this nice man would be responsible for setting free these vile, nasty, despicable creatures into the Catawba Valley, a rat-free community. Perish the thought. Consequently, these cages were very sturdy. He would take one rat out at a time, put it in an experimental cage of about 3 square feet, and inject it with a needle with these poisons to see the reactions. He took very meticulous, careful, and copious notes, wanting to make sure he got every reaction these vile and nasty, despicable creatures had when they received these injections. In March of 1927, after working almost nonstop for 2 weeks, taking merely a few hours of sleep whenever he absolutely had to have it, the good doctor again thought he had the right formula. He had come so close many times, it was so frustrating. He'd pull his hair out, he'd bat his head against the wall, he would spit. He was so angry sometimes. And again, this time, he didn't have it. But he was so tired, he was drowsy, he was sleepy. But he had to put one rat back in its cage. Now, these cages lined the walls, from the very floor to the very ceiling, along the very wall, along the very every wall of that one area of his laboratory, rows and rows of cages of rats. This one particular vile, nasty, despicable creature of a rat had its cage on the top, at the ceiling. It was a tall ceiling, mind you. He had to use a ladder to get to this cage. So he climbed up the ladder, was putting the rat back into its cage, when suddenly the rat bit him! And it shocked him and it scared him. Oh, he was so sleepy. He just didn't want to think. It scared him so bad he fell off the ladder. Oh, how terrible. Because, you see, below the ladder, on the third level of cages, there was a cage door that was open. The rat had long since died, and somehow or another he left the door open that evening. And as he fell off of the ladder, his right leg fell on the cage door that was open with such force as he fell that it broke his leg between the knee and the hip and the thigh area and cut it severely. The force of the fall not only broke his leg, but it knocked him unconscious. And there he was on the floor, a broken leg with his thigh sliced open from this metal, this very hard metal, bleeding horribly bad, unconscious there on the floor. The good doctor was very fortunate because, you see, this was a Tuesday night that this happened. Very, very late of a Tuesday night. Maybe we should say the wee hours of Wednesday morning. Lucky was the good doctor also that his good friend was going away for the day and wanted to come out early on that Wednesday morning. Because when he got there, this friend from Old Fort, he found the good doctor on the floor, unconscious, with a broken leg, bleeding, and he was shocked, he was aghast, he was horrified, he was dismayed, he was surprised, and he was upset. And no Alka-Seltzer back then. So he bandaged the good doctor's leg as best he could, put a splint, which he had learned as a Boy Scout, very valuable training, put the good doctor in the back of his truck and trucked it on back to Old Fort to the community doctor, who could not do much more to help, said, take this good doctor into the brand new hospital at Oteen, because there they have fine, intelligent, well-trained doctors and good chemicals and drugs and painkillers and things like that where he can be taken care of. So as fast as this little old truck could go up Highway 70, weaving and winding back up the Eastern Continental Divide, going near to Andrews Geyser on the way, reaching the top of the Eastern Continental Divide where Ridgecrest is, continuing on to Oteen, to the hospital. The good doctor got there just in time. He was a very lucky fellow. He had bled so much and lost so much blood, he was extremely weak. His pulse was very, very weak. He was in surgery for a long time, getting that leg fixed back up, patching up some of his arteries and veins and such things as that, and his leg, getting that broken leg healed up again. But as he lay in his hospital bed a few days later, when he finally regained consciousness, he asked the doctor who was in there, he said, Doctor, am I alive or am I in heaven? He said, you're alive. He said, you feel that pain in a minute, you'll know you're alive. And sure enough, he did. It hurt. It was bad. He said, ooh, this hurts so bad. But the doctor said, what is even worse than this pain you feel right now is the what you're going to find out when I tell you this in a minute. You see, you have lost, or you did lose, so much blood there that night that your spleen dried up. It basically lost so much blood through your leg, and of course we all know that the blood vessels that return from your bottom of your feet coming back up through the body pass through the spleen to supply the spleen with blood before it goes back to your heart. The spleen did not receive any blood for a several hour period of time, and the tissues began to rot, much like gangrene would set in. So his spleen had to be removed. Sadness, 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 how horrible. Because, you see, the spleen produces a very important element of the blood known as phospholipid acid. Now, without this phospholipid acid, people just cannot survive. You can't live. You're going to slam die without the phospholipid acid. And he had none because his spleen had been removed. And the spleen is the only part of the body that produces this vital element of phospholipid acid. But again, our good doctor was fortunate, because merely a few years earlier, some fine Swedish doctor had discovered a method of creating phospholipid acid artificially out of chemicals for just such an occasion when somebody's spleen should quit working, which was a common occurrence back then and caused many deaths. So the good doctor was very fortunate, because in this hospital at Otene, the newest hospital in the whole country when it was finished, there was a supply of the chemicals necessary to make artificial phospholipid acid. Now, it was in liquid form, which meant he had to have injections because it was too much to swallow. Plus, it tasted horrible. Plus, you didn't need it to swallow him, because that meant it went to your tummy. And he wanted it right in his blood. So he had to have shots into his blood through his hip area. It was very painful, these shots, but they were very important. And every other day, he had to have an injection. Now, there was no way this could be made into tablet form. It just would not work that way. It had to be injections. For well over a month, way into late April, into early May, the good doctor stayed in the hospital at Otene, having these injections every other day, growing stronger, regaining his health every day, till finally, he was healthy again. And he talked to the doctors and said, "Look, doc, I am myself a doctor. I know all about chemistry. I could make this stuff blindfolded if I had the chemicals. I don't have them, but you've got them. So please let me buy some. The Fed grant I've got will take care of it." At first, the doctor said, "Nah, ain't no way. Get in there, you'd be looking at them rats, and you'll forget about it, you'll expire. And then we'll be in a fix." The doctor said, "But listen, doc, if I stay here, I can't work anyhow. You'd be in a fix, because nobody else can work on those rats the way I can do it. Let me go ahead and take a couple of 10 or 12 gallons of this stuff down to my little laboratory, and I can give myself injections." Aha. Finally, the doctors at Otene Hospital were convinced. And they agreed to let the good doctor go back to his laboratory carrying several gallons of the ingredients for phospholipid acid, so that the good doctor could make his own injections and continue with his work. So the good doctor was back at his laboratory with gallons and gallons of liquid chemicals to make the all-important phospholipid acid, so as to keep himself alive. He was motivated. I mean, he was so fired up, it is just hard to imagine. Because, you see, he had been away for weeks in the hospital, not able to do anything. And all this time, all I could think of was rats, nasty, vile, despicable creatures populating the world, taking over, biting people, being horrible, and such things as that. He was so fired up, he couldn't stand it. He got back and he was working, And he was working like crazy, trying to develop that poison that would kill rats yet not harm people. It was mid-May 1928. Now, 1928 was a notable year. Not because of the rat workings, but because of something else, totally unrelated, but in the same area. Because, you see, in the summer of 1928, a camp was begun. This camp was located at the top of the Eastern Continental Divide. This camp was this camp, Camp Ridgecrest, 1928, almost 50 years ago. Just think how close it is. You have walked down to Catawba Falls, or if you have not, you probably will very soon. It's very, very close to our camp where this was going on, all these experiments with dozens and dozens of these vile, nasty, despicable creatures, these rats. The good doctor was working. He worked all that summer. He worked all the fall. I mean, he was working and working and working. He hardly ever took time out to relax. But his work paid off because he made many, many developments and knew he was on the right path to finding a chemical that was poisonous, that would kill rats yet not harm people. He continued to work, and in the fall of 1928, right near Christmas time when it was getting cold, he thought he had it. Down nestled in the Catawba Valley, hard at work in his laboratory in the wee hours of the morning, with crickets outside cricketing and the wind blowing, much as we hear now. He was working and thought that he had it. He worked for 4 days straight, going to the fifth day straight. But you may say, but that's not unusual because he was so diligent. Aha! That might be true. But, you see, he worked so hard, he forgot something very important. Because, you see, he forgot to give himself injections of phosphophthalic acid. He missed 2 injections. But he was so fired up, working so hard, he knew he was so close to getting the formula, he could not dare take out enough time to sleep. And he just plain forgot about his own physical needs. He was so devoted to helping mankind, getting rid of these nasty, vile, despicable creatures. And late one night, in dark, it was so cold, when he forgot to give himself his injections of phosphophthalic acid, suddenly, at his table, he fell back onto the floor. He just totally flaked slam out. He blacked out. He fainted. He was so weak from hunger, from no sleep, from no phosphophthalic acid, that his system just couldn't take it anymore. So there he was on the floor of his laboratory, almost unconscious, in a daze. A horrible condition to be in. When he came to, he did not know how long he had been on the floor, unconscious. He did not know how he got there. But then he realized he felt very, very weak, and he knew it hit him. He had forgotten to take his injections. Panic struck his heart. Fear seized